So I'll tell you right from the beginning that I was disappointed with her choice of the first text that she's doing here, because I was all set up and excited for her to address the first chapter in Yitro, which talks about Yitro's coming to his arrival in the desert and his advice to his son-in-law to share the wealth, or not share the wealth, but to delegate, rather, and to have some kind of system, right, so that the weight isn't entirely on his head. And the great part of the first chapter in the book of Yitro is you have this huge question of when does it happen? And the commentators really have a party on this first chapter of the book of Yitro of when was it that Yitro got to the desert. Was he there for Matan Torah? Was he not there for Matan Torah? What prompted him to come? And if it was not here, you know, you can just look briefly on the bottom. The comments on the bottom address it. But they deal with this huge question of when did this chapter happen. So I was all excited to see Nechama address this major issue. When I teach the book of Shemot, that's what we do. We spend at this time, when we hit this part, I have my students sit down and read the whole book of Shemot. We take 2 weeks on this. They read the whole book of Shemot, start to finish, and come up with an outline of the whole book. First, they do it in smaller units, and then we group units together, and then larger and larger, and then we get to large units, like the Exodus is the first topic, and then, you know, all the travels on the way is the second topic, or coming to Har Sinai and Matan Torah is the third topic. Because then you can really see these big issues. You know the story of Na'aseh v'nishma? What did the Jews say when God said, do you want the Torah? And the Jews said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will listen, right? That's like the big thing. Okay, that doesn't happen until the middle of Parshat Mishpatim, which is way after Matan Torah, way after the Ten Commandments are written. So that begs the question, you know, meaning it makes the question even stronger about, is the Torah written in chronological order? And if not, you say that it is written in chronological order, you have many problems. If you say it's not written in chronological order, then your big question is why? Then is it written in the order in which it's written? So I was so excited to ready to sit down and tackle her first class, and she doesn't talk about it. But she gives a great class anyway. She does present a great class, but it wasn't what I expected to be. She completely skips over the first chapter and goes right to the second chapter. So let's look at the second chapter, verse 19. Sorry, not verse 19. Chapter 19, verse 1. Page 400 and 401. Bachodesh Hashlishi. It's on the third month. Lesef ben Israel marries in China. The third month after the Jews had left Egypt, it takes them 3 months to get to where they're going. Bayom Hazeh, on that day, which Rashi explains is the first day of the month, first day of the third month, Ba'umid Bar Sinai. They came to the desert of Sinai, the Sinai desert. Bayish Umi Refidim. They traveled from Refidim. Ba'umid Bar Sinai. They came to the Sinai desert. Bayachanu Ba'midbar. And they camped in the desert. Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Hahar, and Israel camped there opposite the mountain. And this is the famous Rashi on Vayichan Sham Yisrael, which, by the way, isn't really a question. Rashi's question is, why is Vayichan in the singular form? If you think about it grammatically, it makes sense, because it's talking about Israel as a unit. So it's perfectly acceptable to write it in the singular form. But Rashi here puts in the famous comment that they camped like one nation with one heart, that they were all, and there's a song, one of the recent Jewish singers did a whole song, not so recent, maybe 5-6 years ago. But, okay, so Moshe, and Pasuk Gimel, Moshe Allah El Ha'elokim, Moshe's first time he goes up to God on Har Sinai. They cry of Elav Hashem min ha'ar. Hashem calls him from the top of the mountain. Lemor, he says, Ko tomar lebet Yaakov, v'tagid lebnei Yisrael. You should tell the following to the house of Jacob. I'm on page 400. Tell the following to the house of Jacob.
It's to the women, right?
To the women, says Rashi. V'tagid lebnei Yisrael, and tell bnei Yisrael. Why does it say the women First, this is also a famous Gemara, talks about this because
the same woman.
That Beit Yaakov, look, you can look at Rashi, Beit Yaakov says, Elu Hanashim. Rashi explains that Beit Yaakov is Elu Hanashim, these are the women. The Midrash tells us that Beit Yaakov is the women, and Bnei Yisrael are the men. And why are you telling to the women first? Because if the women don't accept it, then forget it. Mm-hmm. It's shot. Then you don't even have a chance to let the man. There's no point in even presenting it to them. However, if the women do accept it, you're home free. Because it doesn't matter what the men are going to say, because the women will get them to make the right choice. This is what the Midrash says. And this is why Sarah Smira, in her wisdom, 60 years ago, I don't know what... 60 or 70 years ago, in the 30s, before the Second World War, is it 80 years? Oh my goodness, okay. Like Sarah Schneer, in her wisdom, chose to name her movement the Beit Yaakov Movement as a school for women to educate women in Torah and mitzvot, so that they could lead their families with making the proper choice.
But my mother, may I make a
please
comment? My mother grew up in Poland, so
it's where it started.
And she told us that the reason that the women were not taught in school mm-hmm. was that they were afraid to let the girls go out. The boys went to cheder together in groups. Mm-hmm. They did not allow the girls to go out because they were afraid that they would be attacked. And girls who came from homes where there was were people who learned, like my mother was a bas kohen, mm-hmm. and so they learned there. My mother learned Gemara. She was really terrific. But other homes did not have that background in education. The girls learned Shabbos, cooking, and all that.
Right.
But it was not because they didn't want the girls to learn. It's a misnomer.
Right. My understanding was it was also a financial issue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that it could be, it depends on the location.
Well,
yes, it could be also
here,
depends
but
on
there
where.
It was a question
of
safety.
My grandmother, and her sisters were educated at home, and they were not taught cooking. They were taught reading, writing, and
yes, right.
And
I say that in homes where there
reading,
was educated, there
arithmetic. Yes.
Yes, I'm saying that where there were educated people in the home, the girls learned. But if they're, you know, if they were just whatever, they learned much less. But they were really afraid because the Shugutsim really attacked girls, and they were.
Oh, sure.
Afraid.
My grandmother told
Absolutely.
Me many stories of that. In Poland also.
Poland.
So she said though that you knew what, who was in control of Poland that morning based on what language the teachers spoke when you got to school. My grandmother did go to school. They spoke Polish or Russian, and you knew who had gotten control of the border that night.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing on, Hashem says to Moshe in his first encounter with Moshe this time around on Har Sinai, he says to him, Atem ra'item asher ashiti l'mitzrayim. You saw what I did to the Egyptians. Va'asayachem al kanfei nesharim. I carried you on the wings of eagles. Va'aviachem elai, and I brought you to me. And now if you listen to my voice, v'shmartem et b'ti, and you guard my covenant, you will be choice to me over all the other nations, because the whole land is mine. And you will be for me a kingdom, a priest, and a holy nation. These are the words that you should tell the Jewish people. Moshe comes down, he calls to the elders, and he tells them all these things. He tells them all the things that Hashem told him to say. The whole nation answers together. Whatever Hashem says, we'll do it. Moshe brings these words back to Hashem. And there's a whole back and forth of a few ups and downs where Moshe goes up, gets a directive from God, comes down, speaks to Jewish people, gets a response, and returns to Hashem. But as I mentioned before, this is not Moshe's first time in Har Sinai. I said this is his first encounter with Hashem this time around on Har Sinai. When was Moshe's first encounter at Har Sinai? At the bush. So let's turn back to that first encounter. Keep your hands or your little blue marker here. Put the blue marker there, actually, because that's the easiest way to keep it, and the Tuesday class is going to need it anyway. So let's turn back to, do you use Chumashim in the Tuesday class? I would think so.
Yes,
okay, good. All right. I'm in chapter 3, page 300. Actually, I'm going to be on 302. Moshe comes up on the mountain. He sees the burning bush. It's not being consumed. God calls to him. Moshe hides his face. Hashem says, take off your shoes. It's a holy place. Oh, sorry. Then he hides his face. Hashem says, I'm going to come down. I'm going to take the Jewish people out. I'm going to bring them to a land, a beautiful land flowing with milk and honey. And now I want you to go to Paro. We read this part before. Go to Paro and take my people out of Mitzrayim. Moshe says to Hashem at the bottom of 302, Mianochi keilech al Paro humai, I should go to Paro and I'm going to take your people out. Yomer Hashem says, I'll be with you, this is the proof that I have sent you. We did this actually last week. When you take the nation out of Egypt, Tadun et Elohim al Ha'ar Hazeh. Originally, this is Moshe's original mission, what he was told, to take the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim for one express purpose. What's that purpose?
To
serve God. That the physical bondage of Egypt was to be placed with the spiritual bondage of the Jews towards God. And with this, we can begin looking inside on page 290 in our Nechama book. So I set it up for you. When the divine revelation first came to Moses at the burning bush, accompanied by the tidings of redemption, he was told the following. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain, on Har Sinai. In other words, the oppressive service, she says, of Egyptian bondage was replaced by the service of God on this mountain. The spiritual bondage that they're going into signals their release from the physical bondage. As the curtain goes up on the final act of their liberation, in other words, as they're right about to enter into the spiritual bondage, Hashem welcomes them with the following words. Atem ra'item asher asiti l'mitzrayim. This is back to our blue. If you want, you can flip back to the blue marker where we left it. Atem ra'item asher asiti l'mitzrayim. You saw, you yourself saw what I did to the Egyptians. V'asachem al kamfei nesharim, and I bore you on the wings of eagles. And I brought you to me.
So the plural is he's talking to Moshe and Aharon?
He's talking to Moshe, and Moshe is to give this over to the Jewish people. I want to share with you something very interesting that I learned from Rabbi Nachman Levine, our local genius, who he points out that if you think about it grammatically, the word lemor means to say. That when it says, tell the whenever we say something, whenever it says in the Torah, say so-and-so, to say, meaning I'm telling it to you with the express purpose of you should pass this information along. So when he says here, Moshe goes up, Hashem calls him Lemor, to say that he's supposed to say the following, and then he even does say, this is what you're going to tell the Jewish people, and that's when the quotes begin. So he's speaking at Hashem Eitem, and he's talking, Moshe is talking to the Jewish people. Is what he's supposed to tell them. So we're going to take this pasuk and we're going to break it up into three parts. And she does it right in that on those lines on page 290. Number one, Atem re'item asher asiti l'Mitzrayim. That's part one. You yourself saw what I did to the Egyptians. Part two, I took you out on the wings of eagles. And part three, and I brought you to me. So you see also, already you see it's a progression. It's a three-step process from their bondage, their physical bondage, towards their spiritual bondage. So let's address each of the three parts individually. The first part, Atem re'item, you yourself saw what I did to Mitzrayim. And I'm going to ask you to look in the Rashi on your page.
Oh.
It's right here. I know it's Rashi letters. I'm sorry.
The
first editor who came, no, just sorry, in your book.
Oh.
I didn't bring the Rashi because I know we have it in our Chumash. The first person who made up Rashi scripts. Whatever. That's the person I want to meet at the end of days, and really, I have a bone to pick with him. Okay. It's not the Aleph and the Chet. It's just not right. Okay. Atem re'item. Here's what Rashi says. Lo masoret hibiyachem. This is not a tradition. You yourself saw it. Lo dvarim ani meshager lachem. I'm not just like spouting words to you. Lo beidim ani me'id aleichem. I'm not even using witnesses. I'm not telling you about it. You didn't hear about it. I'm not even bringing you somebody who said that they saw it. Meaning you, Ella, atem re'item. You saw it, Asher, Asitu L'Mitzrayim. You yourself, with your own eyes. This is what, you know, this is Asa Torah's big thing about the proof of why Judaism is the number one religion, is the right religion. He says that Rabbi McKenna comes and gives a great talk to the high school students. I mentioned it here before. They say Mohammed was one guy, right? Maybe he forgot to take his pills that day. And he came down and he said, I had a revelation. Jesus was one guy. He didn't even say all his typings, all his teachings with his students, his disciples who gave all the teachings. Judaism is the only religion in which there was a revelation. There's a claim in the Torah of a revelation to 600,000 men, meaning 2.5 million people, let's say, right? Okay. Now, if there's a claim in the Torah of the revelation, let's say for a moment that that wasn't true. Don't you think we would know that by now? But as Eishet Torah, their tagline is, not for Eishet Torah, but their like line here is, a Bobby doesn't lie to her grandchildren. Right? You've heard that before, right? The Bobby doesn't lie to the grandchildren. This is something that's passed on for generation, generation, generation. But the bottom line is, those first people who saw it. And it wasn't one person. It was people, a lot of people. So that's what Hashem is saying. You saw what I did to the Mitzrayim. I'm not even coming to you and saying your Bubby saw it and your Bubby's telling you now. You yourself saw it. So Rashi continues. Al-kama averot hayu chayavim nikodem shenizavgu lachem. There were so many averos that the Mitzrayim owed me for before you were paired up with them. And the Midrash talks about how the Mitzrayim were adulterers, were murderers, were idol worshippers, you know, the big three. But v'lo nifriti mahem ella al yadchem. I waited to punish them until it would save you. That's what I waited for. In other words, Hashem's need for punishing the Mitzrayim took a back seat to what the Jewish people needed. And this is how Nechama points out. So in other words, the scores to be settled with Egypt among the top of page 191 were not as important as a fatherly concern showed by Hashem for Israel. Not what Hashem had done to Egypt, but what he had done to Egypt for the sake of the Jewish people. So Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi comments on this line in Rashi. And I brought it for you again, it's in Rashi script. For some reason, all of the sources that I brought you today on this extra sheet, the additions that I have them in Rashi script. So if you want to go to the YU book sale and order me, you know, buy me the Mizrahi with the black black letters, I'd be happy to use it next time around. Okay, so he comments on Rashi. And the way he does, I'm going to start actually, I'm going to start, what did she say? Okay, I'm going to start, you see where the break is? No, I'm going to start after that. You see where the break is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, four lines before that, in the middle of the line, it says the word V'yamar. Okay, V'yamar means, I'm about to quote Rashi, and Rashi says, remember, Mizrahi is Eliyahu Mizrahi. Here's my information I got from Wikipedia. Eliyahu Mizrahi is 15th century. He's a super commentator on Rashi, which means he wrote his book on Rashi. He's a Talmudist, a poshek and authority on halacha. He lived in Constantinople when he was born. So his family was from Turkey, not from the Spanish exile. Mm-hmm. He's a really smart man. Really smart. Okay.
How do you know it wasn't from the Spanish exile?
Because his family was a Piemaniot or origin, meaning that his family was Turkey, was Turkish. His family.
All right. Because the rulers of Turkey, the Bey, sent ships to Spain to rescue the Jews.
To rescue the Jews.
Yes, they wanted.
So this was, he was born.
People lived there before.
He lived around at that same time, but it says that he was from Piemaniot origin, which I'm assuming means an older Turkish family, that it was a provable kind of thing for them to make that statement like that. So here's what he says. Yamar Rashi says, etc. That the Egyptians owed me for a lot of mitzvahs, a lot of averos. The purpose of this statement is Eino Ela Lahodiyam is only to inform them Shehim Chavivim Lo. Is how dear they were. It's only to inform them how dear they were to him. Kizemeshayim, as he concludes, Beshat Chamal Kamfina Sharim, and I carry you on the wings of eagles. This is all in English, right on page 291 in your box. I just brought you the Hebrew also. The Kevan Shekain. And if so, if the whole purpose of telling them that the Mitzrayim owed him and saying that you saw what happened to him in China, the whole purpose was to say how dear he was to them. In Ma Tam Lo Marlahem, Atem Re'itam Hadvirim Asher Titulim Mitzrayim. Then why did you have to show them? How does that show your affection to say that you saw what I did to the Egyptians? Of course, I understand it shows the affection to say I took you out on the wings of eagles. But to say you saw what I did to the Egyptians, how does that show? That's the way you're showing their affection? How does that show affection? He says, Dilma, perhaps, lo asalah hamash asa rak ba'avur shechatu v'lo ba'avur chibatan. Maybe, you punish them only because they sin, not because you love the Jewish people. There's no proof to me that you love the Jewish people that you punish the Mitzvah. Maybe you punish them just because they deserved it, not because you love the Jewish people. That's why Rashi has to explain and say, "Lomar de perish asher asiti mitzrayim klomar," meaning to say, "Asher asiti lahem ata," that I did for them now, al ha'averot she'asu imachem, on the averot that they did with you, mashalo asiti lahem al ha'averot she'avru kodem, shenizav gulachem. That's why Rashi has to explain what he says. He's explaining Rashi. Rashi says, you saw what I did to the Mitzriim, how I waited to punish them, Rashi says, I waited to punish them till it would save you. So Mizrahi's question is on the Pasuk. The whole tone here is clearly one of salvation, of God loving the Jewish people. I took you on the wings of eagles, I brought you to me, but how does the first part fit into there? He says that's why Rashi has to explain that I'm punishing them now. Not that I punished them before, I'm punishing them now also because of what they did to you. Yeah.
So then the punishment that they actually received at that time must have been a worse punishment than they would have gotten if it just had been for crimes against the Jewish people.
It's for worse than they would have gotten for crimes against humanity. Not crimes against the Jewish people. But since he waited, in other words, they were, before the Jews came along, the Mitzrayim were already deserving. Now once the Jews came, they were deserving even more because now they enslaved the Jewish people, also on top of everything else. So Hashem waited until that was finished to punish them. And that's what shows his love for the Jewish people. Okay. Let's continue. And page 291, yes, timing is everything. The compassion rather than retributive tone of this passage is set by total context. I just said that. The whole thing is talking about compassion. God is referring not to his punitive acts, but to his love for Israel. And this is first addressed to Moshe on Har Sinai. Okay, so that's the first part of the phrase, is you saw what I did in Mitzrayim. How does it show the compassion? Because it shows that Hashem waited until it was beneficial to the Jewish people for him to punish the Egyptians. Now let's talk about the second part of the verse. The second part of the verse is carrying on the wings of eagles. Asayachem al kanfei nesharim. And she starts off by saying that it's clearly a metaphor, right? Did God really swoop in with eagles and put the Jewish people on the eagles' wings?
No.
No, right. El Al wasn't even a twinkle in anybody's eye right then, right?
Well, okay. When they came to Israel, they said they came out and the Sharim was the first time they went on a plane.
Right, on an airplane. Yes.
They wouldn't get on an airplane.
I'm sure. It's probably very scary.
Well, the pilots had to come out and
force them on.
Speak to them and insult them in terms of
these are eagles' wings. So it's clearly a metaphor. Even if you say that airplanes are eagles, even that is metaphorical. So she takes the time now to talk about metaphors in general. And she writes in a very complicated, beautiful, eloquent, poetic way, but I'm just going to sum it up for you in one sentence, which she said, or a little bit. But I recommend that you read it, what she writes, because she writes, So she talks about that metaphors in general, you have to understand that metaphors were used in the Torah for a very specific purpose, that all aspects of the metaphor could be explained. And even when we explain every aspect of the metaphor, there's still going to be aspects that we're missing. Because a metaphor cannot be translated even into abstract thoughts. You can't completely go over it, you know? Because if so, then it's just a code. But it's more than a code, it's a metaphor. So she talks about metaphors. So we'll turn now to page 2. We'll just read it through quickly. Before we can appreciate the full force of this metaphor, a few words on the general significance of metaphors would not be out of place, especially since they are used not infrequently in the Bible. Poetic imagery cannot be translated into abstract terms without losing some of its significance. If it could, a metaphor would be no more than a cipher to be cracked by the one who had the key. The artist does not use imagery where he could express just what he wants to say in so many precise, transparent words. If this were the case, the employment of metaphors would merely constitute a barrier and break on the understanding of the text. The intention is surely not to conceal the author's intention from the reader. We must assume, therefore, that a metaphor, with all its subtle associations and allusions, can never find its exact equivalent in conceptual terms. The full implications will always elude definitions. Its effectiveness and impact derive precisely from this. This is why a metaphor is so beautiful. So go back to our text. Let's summarize some of the ideas that our commentators read into the metaphor. Rashbam explains it simply and unequivocally. Well, let's see what we can come up with. What do you think? Eagles. What's the metaphor of the eagle?
Strong.
Strong, okay.
Swift.
Fast.
Yeah. And it also lives higher than all the other birds. It flies higher
than
all the other birds.
Yes, I know that word from crossword puzzles. A-E-R-I-E.
Right.
It's where the eagles live.
Right.
I don't know how to pronounce that.
Airy.
Airy.
Okay, there you go. But, yeah, so the eagle lives higher than any other bird or any other animal for that matter. All these are good things. If I had a board, I would write them down. Okay, sorry, if I had chalk and an eraser, I would write it on that board. I do have a board. Okay. Rashbam says, and I brought you Rashbam on this separate sheet that you have. I'll come finish around. He says, Shavayti etchem et hayam bayabasha. I passed you through the water on the dry land. Kinesharim sh'ovim yamim derech prichad. Like eagles who pass over waters by flying. In other words, does an eagle get wet when he passes over water? No. Did you get wet when you went through water? No. V'gam shalo huzakten. It also didn't harm you. You weren't harmed. It's explained as it says, and he quotes the pasuk, as an eagle hovers over his nest, etc., etc. The English translation here, I transported you swiftly and safely over the sea in dry land, just like eagles fly over the sea. So we have the swiftness of the eagle, as you mentioned. Safety is sort of like in the air, not sure why it says safely, that you weren't harmed, but further commentaries will explain this. In his view, the metaphor emphasizes the speed and safety of Hashem's deliverance. But does this really exhaust the significance of the image? Like, is that it? Is that all the eagle's about? Even we in our group here came up with more images for the eagle. Admittedly, the following verse, which also resorts to the image of the eagle, more explicitly underlines the quality of swiftness and facility of flight. Yisrael Hashem says later in Devarim, Yisrael Hashem, Alecha goy mirachok nekseh aretz, Hashem will lift you up from very far from the ends of the earth, kasher yid'eh hanesher, like the vulture swoops down. She brings this pasuk. This is also a pasuk that talks about the swiftness of an eagle. But there's a difference in the figure. In the latter, meaning in the one, the last one that she just quoted, the pictures of the eagle's flight. In the former, in our metaphor, there's something that Rashbam left out. How is it described in our metaphor? It's not just that the eagle is mentioned, and not just that the eagle's flight is mentioned, but the eagle is actually carrying something on his arms, on his wings. So that's completely different. It's bearing aloft, it's young. This detail is taken up by Bechorshor. Bechorshor is attributed to Yosef Bechorshor, who is a 12th century French Tosafist. How's that? Okay? All right. And again, if you have the first volume of Nechama at home, in the back of the first volume, she goes through all the people that she uses. So, okay. Bechorshor says as follows, I have raised you to the highest elevation in releasing you from Egyptian slavery, taking you into my service. I, who am the King of Kings, what an awe-inspiring promotion for you. I have borne you aloft on eagle's wings higher than all the other birds of flight, as you mentioned earlier. Bechorshor finds significance in the fact that the eagle is the king of the birds who flies higher than the rest. Rashbam only noted the horizontal flight of the eagle, Bechorshor, the vertical. And the Midrash of the Mechilta addresses the following, notes it also, Mahanesha Hazeh, Olemi Mata Lemala B'Sha'akhtara, just like an eagle flies from downward to up in a short time, Kach Yisrael Olemi Mata Lemala B'Sha'akhtara, also the Jewish people rise up from the depths very quickly. But the foregoing comments do not exhaust the implications of the text. There's still more. Now we have still focusing on the flight, on the location. We didn't talk about this concept of carrying its young. account for no more than the actual image of being born on eagle's wings, but our text speaks of the subject, the Lord, who bore you all aloft. We've only touched on the flight, its swiftness and safety. So Rashi underlines another and more crucial figure of the imagery in his comments on the words on eagle's wings. Rashi says as follows. Kinesher hanosegos alavak nafab, as an eagle bears its young on its wings. Shekol sha'ar ha'ofot, all of the other birds, notes nimik b'nehem ben raglehem. How do they carry their young? In their feet. Refishe mitiar im me'of achir shaparech ha'gavim, because they're afraid that another bird is going to swoop down from above. If they carry their young on their back, then another bird could swoop down from above and grab their young. Aval ha'nesher hazeh, but the eagle, eno mitere ela min ha'adam, the eagle, since it flies higher than anybody else, isn't afraid that a bird is going to swoop down from above. Rather, he's afraid of man, who will shoot up arrows. From the ground. Because no bird is flying above him. Therefore, he puts his young on his wings. And he says, what does he say? It's better that the arrow should go into me and not in my children.
The men, and they put on their talit.
Yes.
They say this.
Right. So we'll get to that even more. That they're covered. Yeah. That the talus is like the kanfenish on him. It's like the wings of eagles. As he finishes up, she doesn't bring. What's that?
I like that.
No,
we sing that.
Why didn't you tell me that a couple years ago?
Oh, you want to wear a talit?
No,
when you do next time.
Oh, that's right. I should have. Yeah,
you can do Hazinu next Parsha Palooza, and you can sing the.
Well, we'll see.
Okay. So Rashi continues, she doesn't bring the end of it, but she says, just like the same way Hashem saved the Jewish people, because remember he put that cloud behind them, so that when the Egyptians threw the arrows went into the cloud instead of into the Jewish people. So the same way that he talks about the same imagery with the bird, with the eagle. So Rashi's analysis of the image complements and adds to the observations of the previous commentators we cited. There are two factors involved, the actual eagle's wings, and the aloft on the eagle's wings, expressing the intimate relationship existing between the bearer and those born, the concern and love of benefactor for beneficiary. Or HaChaim elaborates on this theme. Or HaChaim was much later, I think he was around the 18th, or perhaps even the 19th century, of Chaim ben Atar. He was a Kabbalist. And I brought you a source on the bottom of the photocopy sheet, the Shazpem. And the English, most of the English is on page 294. The Sashem, the top of 294 has most of the English. The Torah Hashem, the Master, writes very long here on the aspect of his love. Skip down to the middle of the third line. He says, look at my love for you, that I love you like a father likes a child. That even from wherever you walked, I had mercy on you. And I carried you on the wings of eagles. Perush ananei kavod, the ananei kavod were laid out under them. And you know, the Midrash talks about that the Ananea Kavod, well, Torah tells us that, the Ananea Kavod, that they were, it smoothed out the whole way for the Jewish people. Like if they were, you're walking, you trip, and there was nowhere to trip. The Ananea Kavod made it all smooth for them in the desert. So, back on page 294, the Or HaChaim, the text and the metaphor, the picture of one who hovers about the clouds, not only far removed from danger, like we pointed out by Rashi, that he flies so high, but also underpinned by a carpet of glory and majesty. That it's from all around. Another aspect of the metaphor is uncovered by Buber. That's Martin Buber, the author of one of the most fabulous works of talking about Hasidic rabbis. I highly recommend it. Second only to Souls on Fire by Elie Wiesel. But, okay. Maya Bubi says, he helps the parallel in the Song of Moshe in Ha'ezinu in Deuteronomy 32:11. And I'd like you to turn there because, just for a moment. I'm on page 1102. Of course, we're going to look in a moment at the Pesukim before and after because he fits very nicely into the context. So, verse 11, Pasuk Yad Aleph. Kinesher Ya'ir Kino. Like an eagle that arouses its nest. Al Gozalav Yerachef. He hovers over its young. Yifros Knafav. Spreads out his wings. Yikachehu. He takes one. Yisa'ehu Al Evrato. And he lifts him up, bearing him, he says, on its pinions. So I think it means its legs, shoulders, you know, on its back, somewhere high up. So Buber mentions as follows in page 294. The newly fledged eaglets, as yet not daring to fly, huddle together in the eyrie.
Just different spelling for her. Don't use it in the
Then you can't use it in the crossword or whatever. Then the eagle rouses his nest, stirs his young to flight, with gentle flapping of his wings hovers over them, the god eagle over the peoples, as once at the beginning of creation, his spirit hovered over the face of the water. But then he spreads his wings, and sets one of the young upon his pinion, carries it away, and by throwing it into the air and catching it, teaches it to fly freely. Why the one? Why else but that it may fly ahead, leading the way for the others? The Ha'ezinu eagle image enables Buber to elucidate that appearing in Arisedra. Here's what he says elsewhere. The great eagle spreads out his wings over the nestlings. He takes up one of them, a shy or weary one, bears it upon his pinions until it can at length dare the flight itself and follow the father in his mounting gyrations. Here we have election, choosing that one, deliverance, removing that one from the nest, and education, teaching that one to fly. All in one. In this way, Buber links the thought content of the metaphor in our text with that directly expressed in the next verse. In our text, when we spoke about the eagles, right after Hashem talks about choosing the Jewish people, if you keep my mitzvot, I have taken you out of Egypt, that selection, the removal, the extraction, and the education. You keep my mitzvot, and then you will be my nation. You'll be a Mamlecha Konim and a Goy Kadosh. You'll be the top of the top. But we must add, I'm in the middle of 295, the eagle of Ha'ezinu is not the same as that of our Sidra. In the former, meaning in the eagle of Ha'ezinu, we have a simile. The benefits God bestows on Israel are compared to those bestowed by the eagle on its young, as the eagle stirs up its nest, for example. In our text, the eagle appears in a metaphor illustrating the way God bestows his benefits on Israel. I bore you aloft in eagle's wings. The differences between the two images. In Ha'ezinu, there's a series of actions. He's hovering, he's spreading his wings, he's choosing one, he's carrying it. Whereas in ours, in Shemot, he's only carrying them on the wings of eagles. Indicate that their respective purposes do not coincide. In Ha'ezinu, the emphasis is on the fatherhood of God, his exclusive and paternal providence. Eagle, in the singular, he hovers, he takes, he bears. In the same spirit, it's linked to the previous verses and the subsequent verses. Look at the whole, the context of this part of Ha'ezinu. He says, he was like an he discovered him in a desert land, in desolation, in the howling wilderness, he encircled him. Yisovavenu, Yuvonanehu, he circled him, he gave him discernment. Yitzrenhu kishon eino, he preserved him like the pupil of his eye. And then, like an eagle, this is a simile, there's that like word in there, as opposed to the metaphor, which is just the image. Here's the like. Just like an eagle will hover and choose his young, etc., etc. Hashem alone guided them. Hashem badad en chenu ve'ein imo el nechar, and no other power was with him. I'm on page 296. It is doubtful if the idea of training and education can be read into them. In our text, on the other hand, the metaphor projects the mode of God's leadership of Israel from the house of bondage to the mountain of God, from Egypt towards him. In this way, the metaphor is linked to immediately preceding and subsequent and succeeding context. you yourself saw what I did in Egypt, then our statement, and then I brought you to me. Further, Our text talks not of an eagle in the singular, but of eagles in the plural. The picture is very different. Here in our text, and you can go back to our pasuk so that we can look at it. Page 402, I carried you on the wings of eagles. You have eagles, you have multiple eagles. Here the heavens are covered, the butte, with flocks of eagles flying their precious cargo swiftly and safely away from the country of imprisonment. Two other features come to the fore, the large numbers involved and the public impact of the Exodus. So you see, this is a very different image than we have, even though we use the image in Hazinu to understand the concept of an eagle. It's being used in a completely different way than here. Here you have many. It's not really referring to God. It's really much more referring to the Anenei HaKavod, to all the circumstances, of course, of which God is controlling. But it's not. It can't be referring directly to God because there are multiple of them. That's the second part of the pasuk. So now the third part of the pasuk is I'm gonna, and I brought you to me. Let's now consider the third part of our passage, and I brought you to myself. Most commentators take this to refer to Mount Sinai, specifically physically. I brought you here, I brought you to me, on which the glory of God descended in fulfillment of the promise made to Moshe at the first revelation, you will serve God on this mountain. Rashbam, however, strikes out on a line of his own. Rashbam, again, is Rashi's grandson. Rashbam's mother was one of Rashi's daughters. Rashbam is the one who writes in his papers that Rashi told me that had he written it all over again, he would have written his papers like I wrote mine. Did I mention that last week? The whole thing? I mentioned a lot. Okay, anyway, Rashbam. So here's what he says, and I brought it for you also on the sheet, on the photocopied sheet. It's the second Rashbam in source number 2. Riyot ani lachem elokim. He strikes out a line of his own. He maintains this third and last section of the verse, I brought you to myself, implies that I should be your God. By this, our commentator wished to emphasize that the last expression is not parallel to the two preceding ones. The first one says, you saw what I did to the Egyptians. The second one says, I carried you on the wings of eagles. Now the third one, and I'm bringing you to me. According to Rashbam, the third one isn't an action. It's not I'm bringing you to me, but via Tchanelai, to be your God. So that I can be your God, meaning that the first two are things that Hashem did, or actions Hashem performed, in order to reach the goal of the third statement. The third statement is the goal. The first two are actions leading up towards the goal, and the third statement is the goal itself. The first two denote the actions performed by God designed to bring the Israelites nearer to the ultimate divine aim. The last expression, I brought you unto myself, describes not another divine action, but the aim itself. God had borne the Israelites on eagle's wings, destroyed Egyptian might, in order to make the Jewish people into his people, in order to promote their recognition of an undivided loyalty to him, in spiritual idiom, in order to be their God. Admittedly, therefore, the gaining of freedom and independence, the promotion of national pride, constitute merely the means to a sublime end. Nevertheless, they're all important in achieving that ultimate aim. Without these being attained, the giving of the Torah was inconceivable. In other words, without that middle piece, without them being taken out of the triumph, without them being carried on eagle's wings, they could not have accomplished the third goal, the goal, which is that Hashem, that they should get the Torah, that Hashem should be their God. The exact relationship between the ultimate divine aim and the instruments essential for attaining that aim is set forth in the following midrash. This is a phenomenal midrash. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak said, the Jewish people, as soon as they got out of Mitzrayim, were worthy of getting the Torah. Immediately. They still haven't reached their best. They came out from a servitude of mud and bricks. The ain yicholim lekabel Torah miyad. You can't get Torah right away from that. Mashallah, mahadamar jomah. What is this compared to? Lamelech sha'amad beno mechol yo. To a king whose son, to his prince, recently recovered from an illness. Lamarlo pidgogo. His teacher said to him, Yelech banech la'ashkule. Shelo. your son should go to school. Amar Hanalei, the king said, Zayim Obaz Zivan Shelbanai. My son hasn't yet reached his full glory. You're telling him he should go to school? Rather, let him regain his strength for 2 or 3 months, the machal, the mishter, with eating well and drinking well. Let him get his strength back. Let him become healthy. Then he'll go to school. Tachamar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what Hashem said. Azayim Obaz Yivan Shalvanai, my sons have not yet reached their peak. It should be Mishubud Haidvil of Enimia too. They left a Shibud, a servitude of mud, of cement and bricks. And you know, Taylan has his heart, I'm going to give them his heart right away. They just got out. Ella Yit Adnu Banai Shnaim Sosha Chodeshim. But let them regain their strength for 2 or 3 months, the man, Uve'er, the slav, by the man, by the well, by the quail. Let them eat a little bit. Regain their strength. Yachagach, and you know, Taylan Mera Torah. Then I will give them the Torah. Emar Tai Wen, Bachodesh Hashlisi, or in the third month.
The same kind of thing. That when they left Egypt, they were at the lowest level of.
So I knew you were going to say that. That's a different midrash.
Okay.
That's the only answer I have, because I'm reading it and I'm thinking, somebody's going to ask about the lowest level. So that's a different midrash. They were at the lowest level of Tumah, but I might be totally wrong, but from my understanding, that midrash doesn't say that when they left Mitzrayim, from the time they left Mitzrayim until the time they got the Torah, they went up in level.
Uh-huh.
Right? My understanding was that they got the Torah when they were on the lowest level of Tumah, because without that, they would have gone down into oblivion. They would have gone beyond. The Torah saved them. So it's a different midrash, but I think it could be worked together in this.
That makes sense.
Okay? All right. A similar idea, I'm on page 298 in the middle, a similar idea is expressed in another midrash. It's also the same kind of thing. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Bar Shalom, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Shalom said, Mashal Leben Malachim Shalaman Mechol Yo. You can compare it to a prince who just recovered from his sickness. Amar Aviv's father said, Namtin lo shlosha chadashim, let him wait 3 months, asher tashuv nafsho min acholi, till he becomes completely healthy. V'achreichein, olichenu l'beit harab, l'olmo Torah. And after that, I will bring him to the rabbi's house to teach, to learn Torah. Afkach, just like here, k'she'atu b'nei shom min Mitzrayim, and the Jews came out of Mitzrayim, hayu behem ba'alei mumin min hashiva. There are people who are really, they were maimed. They were injured from the Shibud. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, Amtin lahem ad sheyitrafu, I'll wait for them to physically be cured. V'achreichein atein lahem et haTorah, and afterwards, I will give them the Torah. And you'll notice that in the beginning of this, of our chapter here, it says, it was in, the parak begins, B'chodesh HaShlishi, in the third month from when they left the time. And that's the month of Sivan. That the third month from when they left the time is when they got the Torah, because they needed time to convalesce, to go through rehab, so to speak, and to really get their strength back. In other words, on page 298, she finishes as follows. He is truly free who lives under the yoke of the Torah. I really believe this. So I don't know if I told you this. I was watching a few weeks ago. Somebody showed me this concept called Internet TV. You know what Internet TV is? Internet TV means that even if you don't have a TV in your home, but you do have the Internet, you can watch things on the Internet. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean just clips from 60 Minutes, which I saw, like the clip of Barbara Walters. Like, they have actual programs that are only on Internet TV. So I was watching this, because I just wanted to see what it was. This Internet TV show, I think, was on NBC.com. The reason was because I turned to my husband and I said, we have to invest in this, in these companies, because this is going to be the future of television. So and he said, oh, you mean like on NBC? So he went on NBC and he showed me there's this TV show, not a TV show, it's an Internet TV show called Friday Night Lights. It's about this small town, wherever in the South, and this football team. You know, the whole town is rallying around the high school football team, and the whole focus is on the Friday Night Lights, on the Friday Night football games. What? I don't know.
No, it was on regular TV.
It was?
Yes, but now this. I think it got canceled when they're showing it.
Oh, they're showing it. Oh, okay.
Whatever.
Right.
But yeah.
So I was watching this thing, and it struck me because I didn't grow up in that atmosphere at all. I mean, my mother tells me that or whatever. I mean, she went to a public high school, you know, but I mean, she wasn't like, whatever, in the She didn't go to Friday night football games, but you know, but the whole culture, and I know it like from movies, but I don't know it personally firsthand. But you know, the whole town is like focused on this football game. This is what they announce on the radio. They're taking bets on who's going to win the next football game. And
well,
running for our boys.
Not the Super Bowl.
But this isn't the Super Bowl. This is some
this
little yokel, local, you know.
The
signs in the stores supporting them. You walk into the store, the quarterback of the team was able to get his father a job in as a used car salesman because he's the quarterback of the team. I mean, the focus of the town. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this with my own glasses, you know, the way I always read all these, watch all these movies and whatever. And I say to myself, you know what? If I didn't have, the day before, I don't know why, like, you know how thoughts pop into your head sometimes and you just have no idea where they come from? So the thought popped into my head was, what if I had a choice to not be from? I mean, we all have a choice, really. But what if, like, I don't know, you know, what if I found out I wasn't Jewish or whatever? What if I didn't, if I wasn't born from, would I choose it? And instantaneously the answer was yes, because I need that structure in my life. Aside from, of course, the positive spiritual benefits, which are innumerable. But even just the structure, that gives a focus and a structure to my life. And when I saw this football game thing, I thought to myself, they need that structure. Everybody needs some kind of focus and structure. When you have structure, and you say this with little kids also, we just had this parenting thing on Saturday night, and one of the things they said is kids need structure. They do. They feel better. And we as adults, we feel, I hate Sundays because Sunday is not structured. And I don't have a plan. And I love that I don't have a plan, and I hate that I don't have a plan. I love it because I can relax and hang around, but I hate it because I don't have a plan. You don't have that structure. So she talks about that he who is truly free is one who lives under the yoke of Torah. Structure as bottom line. And then, of course, on top of that, you have all the positive, amazing spiritual benefits. I mean, that goes without saying. I mean, it doesn't go without saying, but... But the latter, but she said, but the yoke of Torah cannot be imposed on one who still bears the mark of an alien yoke. Only he who has the commandments of God engraved on his soul and who is not subject to human dictates can be called free. The children of Israel were not summoned, and she quotes in the back, she brings his footnote. Rambam talks about the conditions governing Torah observance. He says, quote, a person cannot possibly observe the precepts of Judaism when he is sick, hungry, or thirsty, in battle, or under siege. You can't expect the person to keep the mitzvahs then in those cases. And you have to be complete of mind. The children of Israel were not summoned to the service of God until they had ceased to be in power of service. The road from Egypt to Sinai represented a momentous spiritual and physical transition. And it is this that the text refers to when it states, Atem ra'item, Asher Asitu in the time, you saw what I did to the Egyptians when you were there. V'asaz kamal kamfeinu sharima, I removed you from that situation. I gave you opportunity to rejuvenate for one reason and one reason only, v'avi etchem elai, in order to come here, in order for me to be your God, for me to give you true spiritual freedom through the mitzvahs themselves. So, I wish this week that we see, I find it interesting that she refers to, I mean, you have to, because that's how Torah refers to it, the spiritual freedom as spiritual bondage. Service of God is a spiritual bondage. So I give you the bracha that we see this bondage as complete freedom, because that's the trick. There's the rub.
Sure, call.
Yeah.
When I started the bracha before Shlomo Ezra talks about the Ula, we were redeemed, and then immediately we were born after. Because there isn't a minute between the time we were redeemed and the time that we are still
serving Hashem. Very nice.